name is Shandy Chernow, and you're listening to the Shandyland Podcast. I have a very informative and interesting guest for you today. You might have heard about early introduction of common food allergens like peanuts, but you might not know as much as you want to know. So, in order to talk about it, we've got Mina Lele today from Lil Mixins. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, so you have kids with food allergies.
That's correct. I have actually one kid with food allergies, which is not a clinical study, but I have one kid who was born before the guidance came out and has 10 food allergies. And because I had read the LEAP study, I, you know, did early allergy introduction with my younger son, and he has none. Nice. And that is not, again, a clinical study, N of 2, granted, but
sometimes all we get is anecdotal evidence, you know,
exactly.
Like it just kind of is what it is. It works that way. So talk to me, let's start with first kid, right? 10 food allergies. How did you discover that? Did you have any experience with it? How terrifying was that? Give me the goods.
You know, it was less terrifying than just straight up confusing. And I think I was just confused because no one in my family has anything. Like I don't get hay fever, you know, just nothing. And so when he started developing these things, the doctor first suggested, you know, that it could be a food allergy. I was like, what? That's not possible. You know, and I think most people, you think it's really genetic, that it, you know, it runs in families and whatever else. And it was only after I started Lil Mixins that it occurred to me, well, genetics isn't possible. You can't have something increase 10 to 30X in one generation and blame genetics. Like that doesn't make any sense. I tell the story, but you know, he actually, because he was developing some dry skin and they weren't even sure that they should call it eczema. They tested him and they said he was, you know, had a peanut allergy, but he didn't have an egg allergy. And so we gave him eggs and, you know, immediately he just exploded in hives and stuff. And we didn't do anything. Like we just sat there confused. Like we didn't take him to the ER. We didn't give him medicine for an absurdly long time because we were like, well, it can't be food allergy. They just told us he doesn't have a food allergy. And that was also, you know, my introduction into the fact that food allergy testing is pretty unreliable.
We will definitely talk about diagnostics. This is one of my favorite soapbox topics. Good thing I can speak today. So we'll definitely talk about that. But I mean, that's really, if you look back on it, you know, that's scary, right? You've been told he doesn't have an allergy to something. You're watching with your own eyes as he has an allergic reaction to it.
Yeah.
There's some cognitive dissonance there, huh?
Yeah, totally. And it just took us so long before we finally were like, accept what's in front of your face. Mm-hmm. Take him to the ER because clearly this isn't correct. This is not what people look like after they eat eggs.
Right. That's not how that's supposed to go. Yeah. No, right. That's really scary. So then how did you take that, you know, experience and start Lil Mixins?
Well, so, you know, after that, I was like, well, I don't trust any of the allergy testing. So we just did, I am not the world's most anxious parent. So to put that lightly. And so where everyone was like, oh, you should take him in for food testing. You know, I was like, okay, so they're just going to watch him. Right. So I can do that at home. And so I just did it at home and we tried the other foods and we found out he was definitively allergic to peanuts and not to some of the other things. And then we had our list that he's allergic to eggs, peanuts, all of the tree nuts.
For the record, I don't think that you would recommend that people try the oral food challenge at home.
No, but I don't generally recommend that. Although in this case, it was almost recommended by a doctor. Like they were like, the only way to know is to try things. And so you can give them a tiny amount. And if you notice anything, like just back off, you know? And so we did that. Like, it wasn't like, here's a Reese's cup. We gave him, you know, the tiniest bit of peanut butter and he started itching. And so we were like, okay. And the doctors did guide us and say it was okay to do it that way. I'm not entirely sure why, I suppose, but
Yeah, no, but it goes to that same topic, which again, I want to get back to later, but maybe we'll just tackle now. The information, if you go to 10 different allergists, you're going to get 10 different sets of information, which is super duper frustrating, right? As a new food allergy person.
Totally.
They're very, like with conviction, right? Like,
all of it. That drives me crazy. It's like the level of certainty with which people say things that they definitely don't fully understand. But I think one of the hard parts is like, I definitely don't, you know, I simultaneously do not want to recommend that people do food challenges at home. And yet at the same time, like definitionally every time a kid eats a food for the first time, it's effectively a food challenge. So like, where's the line between the two, right? And I think that's really what our doctor was trying to say. He's like, look, he's young and he has to just keep trying new foods. And what are you going to do? Come into my office for every new food? So,
no.
You know, yeah. And no, so just like, let's keep going and, you know, be extra careful with some of them or the ones that he had potentially tested, you know, with like a ambiguity too and things like that. So they were not being, you're trying to balance. I think one of the challenges is like same thing for our allergists is like, as an allergist, you have to guide the parent to have caution, and yet you don't want to induce unnecessary anxiety about eating. And so there's this line you have to walk where you're like, okay, this is a concern, and yet you have to approach the world like it's still open to you, you know, because you don't want to preemptively cause
it. It's all based on a bad diagnostic, right? You do the skin test or whatever, and it doesn't mean anything. To your point, right? You fed your kid eggs right after he tested negative for eggs. Yeah. I'm the same way, right? I don't test positive for everything I react to. And so you're taking a bad test and then trying to give good advice. And that's,
yeah, really challenging.
That's good, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So tell me how you started Lil Mixins.
Well, the LEAP study, I tell the story a lot, but so my son went into that first allergic reaction that we took him to the ER for, and it was 1 week later that the LEAP study was published in New England Journal of Medicine. And, you know, I am a clinical researcher, so I read the New England Journal of Medicine, or at least skim it to see if there's anything, you know, relevant to whatever I'm working on at the time.
And the LEAP study is about early introduction of food.
Exactly. Yeah. So the LEAP study is the first to show that early introduction could effectively prevent food allergies. And I was, you know, I was just kind of furious because, the thing that I was particularly furious about, which is somewhat esoteric, is because I have worked on papers that have been published in journals, I know the time cycle between when you get your data and then when it ends up in New England Journal of Medicine, and it's like a year. And so they knew this a year ago, like when I was pregnant, and yet I, you know, and not only was I not told, like, that's just the first time you're telling doctors, and it's going to be two more years before the average parent knows. You know, and I was like, if you know this very critical piece of information, you need to tell people. But the thing is, like, I've worked in medical devices forever, and there is a huge gap that is often unappreciated between the science that is very clear and definitive and what the heck that means for the average person. And medicine is often really good at getting up to the scientific conclusion, and for a whole slew of reasons, doesn't close the loop on, but how is everyone going to do that? And you take the LEAP study, for example, and it showed that a baby needed to eat, starting as young as 4 months old, a food that they will choke on 3 times a week in a certain amount. And you're like, well, how is a parent supposed to know, like, that they're giving the right serving size, fit that into their schedule? And then you extrapolate out from the LEAP study and talk about eggs and all the other nuts. And you're thinking, like, how, you run out of meals really quickly, you know, in a day or time in your schedule to do it. And so immediately my concern was, like, this is a tool we have to prevent lifelong illnesses in a huge percentage of the kids, right? So 80% is not 100%, but oh man, what would I give to have my kid not be sick for the rest of his life, right? And if all we have to do is make this easy for people, that should be, you know, that should be what everyone's racing to do. And along with Lil Mixins, there are other companies, of course, that did immediately race to do this. And I think one of the things that's different about the Little Mixon's approach is that we actually are trying, we're taking a minimalist approach to it, which has its, you know, ups and downs. But my goal is not to replace real eating, right? My goal is to support a parent in these very early stages of like 4 months to 8 months, where they really need help in understanding what are safe form factors, what's the right serving size. Because once your kid gets to the place where if you spread a tablespoon of peanut butter on, you know, a couple crackers and they're going to eat that as a healthy snack, like by all means, like please don't use commercial products when you don't need to. But that those early months are so critical that I really wanted to help because that can make all the difference. And, you know, and I think that's really where Little Mixins is focused on how can we really help parents in this critical time point and do it in a way that's as unobtrusive and hopefully as budget friendly as possible.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. I mean, when my kids were little, it was flip-flopped the other way, right? Stay away until they're at least two or whatever, right? And I feel like that's not the only flop that's happened. I feel like it's kind of gone back and forth. Not that anybody who's listening can watch my hands make crazy motions, but I feel like it's gone back and forth, maybe not a bajillion times, but a couple, right? Yeah. How do we know that we're right? And how do you kind of measure success when we don't have a good diagnostic test? Maybe that's a
good question. Actually, why do we know that we're correct is because the previous recommendation to avoid foods was not based on any clinical data. It's utterly unclear to me how they decided and why they made a pediatric guideline based on something that had zero data to support it. So in this case, they did the correct thing, which was do a randomized controlled study. And it's highly unlikely that this sort of guidance will be reversed because it's now been replicated in multiple randomized controlled studies. So unless humans fundamentally change, you know, we shouldn't see something very different in the future.
Are we measuring it against skin tests? Are we measuring it against anaphylactic reactions? Like what's the measure?
Oral food challenge.
The other side. Okay.
Oral food challenge. Yeah. So the only true test. Yeah. The only true test, oral food challenge, right? Do they eat it and do they react? And so we know that data is quite sound. So I'm not particularly concerned in any way that that'll be reversed going forward. And now there's more and more studies, you know, looking at other foods, like looking specifically at milk, looking specifically at egg, looking specifically at the various nuts and things like that. And we keep seeing the same thing replicated over and over. I think the big outstanding question in this space is like, what is the floor of what's needed, right? And I think there's still, because for the LEAP study, for example, and every study, you have to pick a protocol. You have to say, a little bit arbitrarily, like we're going to eat X amount, Y times a week.
Right.
Exactly. And the question will always be, if you pick a protocol, like, yeah, if you pick a protocol, like 2 grams, 2 times a week, are we sure that 2 grams, 1 time a week wouldn't have worked? And so you do these subsequent analyses where you look at the people who failed to follow the protocol, which you always get plenty of those. And you see like, where was the cutoff? Because the people will still report what they did. And you can sort of see like where's the floor of what's needed, but then you still get the same question. Like, let's say you get to understanding something like 2 grams a week is important. Well, is it the same thing to eat 2 grams once a week or a third of a gram 7 times a week?
I like the quick math on that, by the way. So what are your thoughts? And I realize it'll be a long time before we see what this looks like, but what are your thoughts on how this will affect adult onset allergies?
So adult onset allergies.
I know that we're into total speculation at this point, but.
You know, it's less speculation, I think, than many people believe. Because even with childhood allergies, right? Again, back to that early discussion of how could something have happened that went 10x, 30x in one generation, right? There's only so many things. Again, human beings are still human beings. Like, you know, like there are some people that have mated with people of 2 generations earlier. So we know in those, like, what are those called? August, December relationships?
May, December, right? I think.
May, December. Thank you. Yeah, whatever. So we know that humans are still humans a couple generations later. But the maybe that part you'd have to cut out of the interview.
maybe it's definitely funny. Staying in.
So what else could possibly change?
Allergies is where we were.
So the question is, what else could possibly have changed, right? And we know certain environmental factors have changed. We know certain things have changed, but we can measure and show that, for example, in children, there was a great study that came out recently where they can look at monozygotic twins. So twins that are identical twins, right? They shared an egg where one kid develops a food allergy and one doesn't. And there's one study done out of Stanford looked at 18 pairs of these. And that's obviously always like the best case scenario in science, right? Because you can't get more like controlled for every other thing. Because they're raised in the same household, same exact age, probably fed the same things, yada, yada, yada. And the one difference you see between them, obviously is not genetics, is that their microbiomes are pretty different. And the kids with certain microbiome profiles are much more likely to develop food allergies.
Gut health,
yeah. So I will say gut health, but also microbiome implies your skin health, right? Okay. Your lung health. And almost all of the research is on gut microbiome, granted, but we do know, for example, that certain changes to skin microbiome will basically cause eczema or increase the risk of developing eczema. And eczema is a huge precursor to food allergies. And eczema, food allergies, and asthma are actually all the same disease showing up in different organs, right? So, but yes, gut health. And my point on the adult allergies, the whole long-winded lead-in was that what's going on in adults is our gut health can change over time. So even if you were born and had good gut health as a child, but now as an adult, you've spent 30 years eating quite poorly, maybe your environmental exposures, whatever, have drastically changed that, you can now develop food allergies because of that. So it's not something that's, and the other side of it though, is that it should give us hope that it's quite reversible.
That was going to be my next question. So thank you for that. That would be great. Get rid of these.
And that's not something I am working on, but there are a lot of, brilliant scientists and starting companies and stuff. They are working on that, trying to understand how can we reverse that effect. Because a food allergy is always your immune system overreacting to something. So all you really have to do is get your immune system to stop overreacting.
You make it sound so simple.
Yes, exactly. Right. How to do that is not straightforward, but when you know what your goal is, at least you can work towards it.
Truth. Look, anybody who's listening, who's developing my better immune system, sign me up. I'm in. I would really like to have a crab again because I am from Maryland and I miss it. So I would love to hear that get figured out. So I like to ask about advice. Mm-hmm. Because you have clearly done an amazing job, A, at mothering, and B, at creating a company that is kind of the hot topic. So let's talk about what advice you have for a couple of different categories. Let's start with food allergy moms. Moms out there, or dads, just for the record, we love dads too. Find out their kid has a food allergy. What do you do?
Depending on how old that child is, I would say that if your child is under age 3 and the younger they are that you find out they have a food allergy, you should consider that quite reversible. And more data is coming out showing that the younger they are, the better their odds of responding positively to oral immune therapy, to other interventions, even like, using probiotics, other dietary changes and things like that can, when their immune system is quite plastic, you can shift things back. And so it's not a good strategy, actually, it turns out, unfortunately, the opposite of what we were told, to wait until the child is older to try, to try and deal with it then. So that's, I think, my number one advice is if they're young enough, be aggressive about trying to shift that system back into a place of homeostasis is the correct term, but just being happy.
My 11-year-old was allergic to mangoes, eggs, and pork, I think was his list when he turned, one or something like that. And the advice was, don't eat that and come back in a couple of years and we'll retest you and see if you grew out of it. And then you can eat it. And I didn't know. I didn't have any allergies yet at this point. I didn't, or maybe just I had the pork, but nothing else. And so that's what we did. And I had to bring a mango in. They didn't have a mango test. So I had to bring a mango so they could scratch him with it.
Right. And there's, I mean, I would say, I think there's an allergist, as you mentioned earlier, there's a big variety of like their aggressiveness and everything else. And I think that right now, it's actually probably a good idea to try and find one who is a bit more aggressive when your child is quite young, about trying to treat and do a, you know, reverse these things. It's hard, you know, because I was just joking with someone the other day, maybe yesterday, that the fact that allergy and immunology is actually one specialty to tell you everything you need to know about how much we know about allergy. Because I mean, obviously allergies are based on the immune system, but what I'm trying to say is like today allergy feels like it should definitely be its own field with its, there's enough people that need help from an allergist, and yet like they are the same people dealing with, you know, immunological diseases like COVID and stuff like that. And that means that we don't have enough of them.
Yeah. And I would actually take it a step further and separate out environmental and food, right? I mean, you get all these testing and that's a whole other topic. But when you don't have somebody who is really focused in on food allergies, it's very difficult to get good advice, you know, to do with them. But all right. So advice on entrepreneuring. You decided to start your own company. Somebody else has a good idea. They want to put a product to market. What do you tell them?
This is always really a challenge. You know, I'm an incredibly risk-averse person, actually. And I was on the early team of two startups before I did this. And I would never have done this had I not gone through those two experiences to feel rightly or, you know, correctly or incorrectly that I had developed some amount of experience and know-how. I think it's always just, it's a lot harder than you think. And it's a lot of just beating your head against a wall until the wall breaks or your head breaks. But just be ready for either one.
You know what? I don't know that anybody's ever given such good entrepreneurial advice that has hit quite as hard as that. I love it. So not only did you decide to start a company with a product, but then you have to figure out how to manufacture it. And in the world of food allergies, which means your set of manufacturing stuff is has an entirely another level of making sure everything is clean and not cross-contaminated and all that stuff. Yes?
Yes.
All right. So how do you deal with that?
So we solve this problem by, I mean, there are standards of, you know, washing and testing and swabbing your equipment and things like that. But interestingly, it was solved for us by the fact that because every manufacturer is so nervous about food allergies, like it's actually really hard at this point to find someone who will deal with peanuts. Or like if you wanted to deal with tree nuts, you immediately write off like half of the plants in the country. They're like, no, we don't want to deal with cross-contamination risk, right? So so all of our proteins are actually made in different facilities, which works out great from a cross-contamination perspective, facilities that don't handle the other things because they don't want the cross-contamination either. So they're all in specialized facilities. And then in the, at the last step, though, we do have to package them in the same place. And so, you know, you do run them on different weeks and you to pull apart the machines completely and clean them and everything. And we do a lot of things by hand because hands are actually a lot easier to clean than machinery.
So you're producing peanut powder over here, trucking it in some big, huge, massive crate?
Sacks.
Sacks. And then packing it in a whole different entire place. I wouldn't have envisioned that.
Yeah, it's not the most efficient way to do things, but it does solve a lot of those issues.
So what would you do differently if you could go back and kind of start again?
Nothing really. I mean, I think it's really a scale thing. Like at some point it might make sense to do it all, but even then you'd want, you know, separate rooms for each thing. So you'd effectively have the same setup, but just all in one campus, you know?
So did you have to do these count as like a medical product or is it just a food?
No, that's fair. We're labeled as a dietary supplement. And it's an interesting question because people ask me a lot, like when I was first starting the company, like, do you have to get FDA approval for these things? And the interesting response is that you can't get FDA approval. The FDA doesn't actually regulate non-medicine. So they do regulate it. They don't, they don't approve through their medical process, so devices. And I have, through my last couple companies, I do have experience getting products FDA approved in the medical device space. And so I also had a lot of experience with, like, what is a good quality system look like? Because the details are a bit different from food from medical devices, but the overall concept is the same, right? You're trying to stop contamination. You're trying to keep people safe. You're trying to develop a high quality product with systems that are, error proof. And so the concepts are really similar.
So it's interesting, right? Because there is, like, the OIT stuff, right, is peanut powder, which is what you're mixing in. That one needs FDA approval, and this one doesn't.
You need an FDA approval. So they are a medical device now, or they are considered a drug at that point, and at the point that they're used for oral immune therapy. And the difference is that they're used for a specific, it's really about the claim that they're trying to make. As long as we don't make a claim per se on our products, our claim is just that we make early allergen introduction easy, which is what keeps us in the food space. And that is all we're trying to do. And the last big thing about, with, like, Palforzia, for example, is in OIT or oral immunotherapy, they are trying to get to, it's all about the tolerancing. Like, they're trying to get to exactly 0.2 milligrams or whatever, right? So our packets, when we say it has 2 grams of protein, there's a tolerance that's allowed on that. Like, it can be anywhere from 1.9 to 2.1, right? And that's not a big difference. It's not a meaningful difference for this use. But for that would make a big difference, right? And so that's really, and in fact, the FDA really is regulating their manufacturing procedure that guarantees that they are toleranced to produce things that are exactly in those pills.
Yeah, it's an interesting difference, right? Kind of the same, but different, and, totally different attacks to the problem. Yeah, no, so actually I had another question that I didn't, I skipped over, which was, how does this fit in with, like, OIT? What are your thoughts on, I guess they're just kind of in completely different spaces in our same space.
Yes, they're before and after the problem, right? It's like wearing a seatbelt, and before you get in the car accident to prevent, the injury, and the cast afterwards. Or maybe that's not the greatest analogy, but
that's a good analogy. It works. It's clear.
So it's just a different space. I will say that it's getting very fuzzy though, because a lot of doctors are doing office-based OIT. And they are saying, like, I want you to eat peanut powder, and they will measure it, but it's not toleranced like a Palforzia, and it's working. So it's bringing up the question, like, does it need to be toleranced that well, or can it, does OIT work just as well if we just say, like, an eighth of a teaspoon of peanut powder, or whatever. And disclaimer, I'm not making the recommendation that anyone use little mix-ins for OIT. That is not what it is labeled for or intended for.
Don't try this at home.
Right. You give the example of mango, right? Like, so what, we just wait forever? But someone's going to start saying, like, okay, we'll bring in a mango and we'll have you eat X amount of mango, and then we'll do 2X and then 3X and 4X. And
yeah,
not every mango is going to be exactly the same.
Those little scratchy things they use for the scratch test, right? He held the mango, he stabbed the mango, and then he scratched my kid. Like, that's how scientific that test was. Like, did he get enough mango on there? I have no idea.
Right. And I guess
came home and fed him mango, right? Like, that's what happened.
I guess the pills are great or really important for kids who are at, you need to start at that, 0.2 milligrams kind of level, because again, then it matters if it's 0.2 or 0.4. But if a kid can already, without reacting, get to like 5 milligrams or something, I'm just kind of making up numbers, which is a size that you can actually measure out, then you can actually just start with food. And that's going to vary by child and or person. Hard to say.
The whole thing is so fascinating. Now I really want to fix my gut biome too.
I highly recommend it.
Little Mixins is amazing product, and I want you to tell everybody how to find it online.
Yeah, you can. We are sold on Target.com and Target around the country, and Amazon.com. And then you can also always find us at lilmixins, lilmixins.com. And we have this strong belief that the most important thing in this space is being a partner to parents and educating them so they feel comfortable and knowledgeable about what they're doing. I think that the biggest, single biggest problem in medicine today is that we use an outdated mode where people are just supposed to listen to their doctor and not ask any questions. And yet things are changing so rapidly that you need to partner with people. And so we have some really great content on the website because I want everyone to walk away feeling like they have agency and empowered to really understand what they're doing.
I like it. I think that's really great. Well, I really appreciate you being here. And so here comes the tricky part. I like to wrap all of these episodes up with two truths and a lie, my favorite little game of torture, if you will. You are going to give us two facts about yourself, one not so fact, and we're not going to tell them which one is which. Listeners, if you want to know.
I'm supposed to give you three, though, right?
Yeah. So two truths and one, untrue. Yep. But in no particular order. And listeners, we're not going to tell you which one is which. If you want to know which one is incorrect about Meenal, then you are going to have to come to us on social media or in the comments on the podcast. And Meenal, take it away. Two truths and a lie.
Yeah. So three, in air quotes, truths about me is I loved backpacking in my early 20s and I visited every continent with people on it. So not Antarctica. The second one is, though I worked at a medical device company on needles, I'm deathly scared of needles and I faint when I get vaccines. And the third one is that I eat at least two bananas every day.
A lot of potassium. All right. I like it. Those are perfect. Perfectly random and all perfectly plausible. So that is great. And I hope that everybody has enjoyed hearing about early introduction and little mixins. And Meenal, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Listeners, as always, thanks for hanging out with us, and we will talk to you soon.